This is the Skirted Roundtable. I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings.
And this is Megan Urquhart from Beach Bungalow 8.
And Joni Webb with Cota, Texas.
And this week on the Skirted Roundtable, we are welcoming design master icon David Easton to the Skirted Roundtable. So David, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, you're very welcome, and I'm on bended knee for being with you all today.
We are going to be talking, we want to hear all about how you got to be who you are, and we're going to talk about your book and whatever else happens to come up. So, David, please tell us, you know, about your background and your education and a little bit about your career.
Well, first of all, I'm 185 years old.
You sound great.
Secondly, no, I don't know whether this is pertinent. My parents were, actually, sometimes I've thought that it is. My father was with the FDIC, the Federal Banking System, or whatever it was. And they traveled around a lot. And finally, my father was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is the capital of Pennsylvania. And my father was there running the FDIC bank there. And my mother put her foot down. She said she was never moving again, and she wanted to live in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So they had some friends that lived in York, and so I grew up in York, Pennsylvania. And it was a wonderful town. There was, at one point, 5 farmers markets. I went back a couple of years ago on a nostalgia trip, and there was only 2 left. Mm-hmm. And but the theaters now are open on Sunday. They used to be closed. It was a wonderful little town to grow up in. We had a bigger space than that because my mother's parents were from Chicago, and I'd spend the summers there, and we traveled a lot, etc. But it was a very lovely town to grow up in, and the photograph of the house is in the book. You know, a typical American Georgian kind of adaptation house with a hall down the middle, kitchen in the back, dining room, breakfast room, and 2 porches, which I still love porches on houses, because I, with great pleasure as a child, we'd have breakfast on, you know, and sometimes lunch on one, and my parents would play cards and drink with friends on the other. And so it was a nice way of growing up.
Is this the house in York or the one in Chicago?
No, this is the house in York.
Okay. Yeah. I see
it's a beautiful
house. Yeah, it's a beautiful house.
On page 10.
Yeah.
It was a nice house, and it was nice growing up in a small town.
So how did you decide you wanted to become an architect? I mean, was it something you wanted since you were a little boy, or?
Well, it was, you know, that's a kind of curious story, because I've thought about it a lot, and I realized it was, and it's still there, but it's become Macy's or something. There was a wonderful department store that in Chicago called Marshall Fields and Company. And they had like 12 floors, and the 8th floor was the furniture department. And in the furniture department, they had 3 houses that you could walk into. And that was fascinating as a child. I mean, God, and you know, my mother and my aunts would all come there, and we'd go to Marshall Field and shop and go to the Walnut Room and have lunch. And then sometimes we'd go after we'd seen the houses and the antiques there. And I'd been to the toy department on the 4th floor. We would go across to the Art Institute of Chicago, and there were the Ward Thorne room, miniature rooms. Mm-hmm. And we could, they're wonderful, beautiful recreations of rooms across history, basically. It was a wonderful 30s room, and there are beautiful early American houses. And I think both of those, plus an introduction through friends of my parents that lived north of Chicago, learned about David Adler. And David Adler has always been, or was always to me, a great god in terms of American classical architecture, because it was wonderful architecture, handsomely done, edited cleanly, but kept the essence of what the traditional style was. Those were the things that were really important to me in terms of, I guess I, you know, that was my life because, you know, partially because, and I thought about it. I'm not bringing it up for the first time to you. I brought it up to myself many times. Why the hell am I doing what I'm doing? And unendingly doing. So it was a great introduction and a strange route, but that's what happened.
You know, that's interesting you said that about Marshall Fields, because as a child, I remember that was my favorite thing to do, was go to furniture stores and just walk around and imagine, you know, myself, you know, living in those rooms. And so it's funny, I've never heard anyone else say that about, you know, having a push from a furniture store, but I can relate to that totally.
Well, what are your stories? How did you get doing what you're doing?
Well, I just knew. I just knew I always wanted to be, but I didn't know what it was, you know. But I just think I was born this way, you know. And I had an aunt that would bring me old magazines, design magazines, and I would be so mad because they would be 10 years old and they wouldn't be new, and, you know. And then my parents built a house, and that when I was in the third grade, and the floor plans, I was just so fascinated with the whole process of that building a house, you know. So I wanted to be an architect until I realized I wasn't smart enough, you know.
That's it. And what about your drinking? Can I talk the way I want to?
Sure.
Yes.
Oh, but then there was the drinking problem.
Yeah, the drink. Well, no. I'm a child of the 70s. We didn't have, alcohol wasn't our problem.
Oh, that wasn't your problem.
Oh, well, let's get into that.
We had other issues that were our problem in college.
Oh, well, I had a little of that too, but with God's help, everything is okay. Yeah. What about the other two of you? How did you get involved?
My father actually was an architect. I grew up in the Midwest, and it's
Where?
Funny because Kansas City.
Okay.
And he probably, you know, I always joke about the fact that when I was growing up, all of our vacation photographs are of buildings and details. None of us. There are hardly any pictures of us because my father would shoot all these and we would have pages and pages of slides.
I love you, honey, but let me get back to what I wanted to.
So exactly. So I think that he had a huge influence. They also were big. They, you know, collected art. And so from being exposed to their friends and other people who collected art and growing up around it and growing up around, you know, always having things pointed out to me, you're talking about in Chicago, of course, we were in Chicago quite a bit. I know exactly what you're talking about in the Art Institute. And I, like Joni, used to go through, you know, the little fake vignettes that were set up in department stores, and same thing. You just sort of imagine yourself, just the creating of this environment. Was something to just pull
for a child.
Yeah.
Fantasy.
Yeah. Okay. So I would guess that would be my.
With you.
I guess my story is, well, my parents were kind of big do-it-yourselfers, but big love of antiques and, you know, nice furniture and that sort of thing. But I actually went to music school to be a performer. But it should have told me something that my first apartment in college, I showed up with window treatments for the windows and that I had made. And, you know, we had seen the apartment the year before and I had measured the windows and showed up. And my roommates were all like, okay, you know, I brought cable TV and you brought curtains, you know. But that
we are nesting.
Yeah, you know, I just everything always had to match and had to go well, and so every apartment I lived in was like that. I made the slip covers, you know, I was very good at hiding the poor circumstances with, you know, a lot of fabric, and then I just in my mid 30s actually I was working in business in public television, and my mid 30s I just thought this isn't what I want to do, and everyone always said, you know, have you ever thought of decorating? So I went back to school and got a certificate in decorative arts, and off I went.
And here you are.
Here I am.
Here are all four of us.
And, who, mm-hmm. you know, who would have thought?
Yeah, who would have thunk that?
Who would have thunk
David,
that?
David, Mr. Easton.
David.
What do you prefer, architecture or interior design, or do you like to do both?
Well, this will sound pompous, but I don't think there's any great architecture without great interiors and landscape. I think they're one thing. I think it's one, you know, it's like a piece of sculpture in a way. And I don't necessarily think that has to be, but I think it's a greater pleasure to create the whole process and have it finished. And secondly, I think as I said before, the end product is better. Because it's a totality. It's just like music, you know, all the rhythm that goes into it is there. That doesn't mean that they're not great houses that other people have come in and done, but I just don't see that they have the same logic and character.
See, I think that's... Go ahead.
I was just going to say almost the same thing. I think there's a certain totality that's logical in anything that's great. You know, if someone writes a book, I'm reading a book on Tolstoy right now, and it talks about the trauma that he and the trauma he put his wife through, driven to do something, but he always wanted to control the product. And I think it makes greater harmony and beauty in terms of Home Sweet Home.
I think that's really interesting because, as I told you earlier, my father was an architect, and he never seemed that interested in the interior decoration. He was more interested in the angles and the lines and, you know, that sort of theory of architecture. And your classicism and that sort of thing, it makes so much sense that the interior decoration would also go. My father was more a modernist, 50s, 60s, pretty clean modernist. So it's interesting to me to hear another architect, because you're actually more what I lean toward. My father hated antiques, and I loved them. I loved them for their history and that sort of thing. So it never made sense to me why he didn't feel exactly what you did, that the inside should match the outside. I almost felt that I saw a thing on Philip Johnson, and he was talking about a space that he had designed, and he did not want furniture in it. The idea was all about the angles and the space and the shadow and that sort of thing.
Well, when you look at the glass house, up in Connecticut, the one thing about modern architecture is it's sometimes coldness, but also mm-hmm. there is an iteration of simplicity and direct relationship to architecture pure.
Right.
But as I said, it doth not necessarily, when you sat in that living room, you had a couple of benches around and some chairs, and it was not particularly comfortable. And I understand why he said that. I will say that the magic of that house was to be in that house at night with the lights dim in the house, and all four walls became tapestry of landscape because the landscape was lit.
Well, I think it's interesting when you're talking the introduction of your book, David, because you came from a much more modern, working for Edward Warmley, place. And then when you started working for Hadley Parish, you started realizing how the interiors, the modernist is all about the architecture, and that the interiors just sort of fit with the architecture strictly, regardless of comfort.
Yeah, and it is. I believe that. And I will say that I'd come from a very purist background. Even Edward Warmley's furniture's in the Museum of Modern Art and all of that kind of business. And I had some inkling of it because of, traveling in Europe, etc. But I did learn that you should be comfortable in a room. I did learn that there's a sofa and chairs around it. And, all those things that Mrs. Parrish was, and Albert, who's still alive and with us and is a wonderful human being, she knew how to make people comfortable. Modern architects don't. It looks wonderful. It's like sculpture. You know, mm-hmm. the furniture is like sculpture in a space, and that's great too, but it doth not necessarily make, comfort.
I think they're two different minds, though. I almost think it's sort of the function of the brain. My father was very mathematical and very, that's what appealed to him. I don't think he thought beyond that. I mean, not to take it away from him, because he was an incredibly gifted architect, but what you're doing to me and bringing in all of the detailing of the decoration on the inside makes more sense to me.
Well, there's a totality. It was like classical architecture was done. I mean, in England or in Italy, it was much a one player. There was only one person that choreographed. That was other than the owner, and that was the architect that really put it together. It's a different world. I think we're coming closer and closer to, I think we're coming closer and closer to a lot of things that I might not really like, but I, or be pleased with or feel comfortable with. But whatever it is, it's changing. And I think it's changing towards a simpler and simpler architecture. In fact, subtext, a couple of years ago, we were working for the chairman of Sony Corporation in the Museum of Modern Art Towers. And I was asked, because I was part of this group of decorators here in New York that were doing rooms and things, And I was asked to do an exhibit, you know, to put, you know, coordinate an exhibit that was going to be in a space that was fairly large and long. And I thought, Jesus, what are we going to do this? So the Sony people had, he and his wife had these engineers come over. And this is subtext everything, but that's why it was one of the things that's always stuck in my head about the move towards the simplicity of a modern life. They said, these three men said, in my questioning them about how to do this, well, you know, there's other ways of doing it. And they were talking about in the future, technology will sense what we want when we walk into a space, and that space will be what we want. They didn't talk about furniture. They didn't talk about decoration. They didn't talk about architecture. They talked about this envelope space that you'd walk into, and with our mind, it would be what we wanted. And I said, well, where are you going to sit? He said, well, consider architecture part of furniture, and it's part of the wall, and it becomes part of what you want. So, you know, there's I read science fiction. I'm sure you, a lot of people don't. They can't stand it. But I the longer I live, the more I realize that maybe that's where we're headed in the future. And I think that's exciting too.
I think the best, I'm stuck in, I don't know, maybe I believe in reincarnation somehow, because I just always, there's something about historical spaces that draw me to them.
Yeah, but they're not saying that these couldn't be historical spaces. They're saying the mind and technology will create an atmosphere that we want. Whatever we dream of, it will be.
But mm-hmm. I'm wondering, though, then what's, if the role of sort of the architect designer is, you know, to help people find that, if people don't have that because it's whatever they want it to be, what happens to architecture and design? Doesn't that just then stop?
I've thought about it. You've posited a very good question. I can't answer that exactly. I do know, feel very strongly, that the future is not the past. It just can't be. We, you know, what was it in 1800 there were 1 billion people. By 2050 there'll be almost 10 billion people on this earth. Everything's going to change. I'm not a Cassandra. I'm not being negative. I'm excited about it. But the world we grew up in is not the world of the future. I don't think. I'm not being ponderous. I'm very excited about the intellectual concept of the way a house could be. When you look at the Japanese houses, have either of you been to Kyoto, to one of those Rotan, the wonderful inns?
No,
I have not.
Okay, well, look at a book of them. They are so simple. And out from the back of a wall comes a pillow that sits on the floor and a table that's moved in place. I mean, it's not exactly what I was just talking about, but there are simpler ways to live. And I think much of the, I sound like a priest, I don't mean to. I think part of the beauty that we felt in the past and the satisfaction we felt in the ambiance and comfort of a place we live is going to change because of our minds and the way life will be. And a lot of it's going to be technology. I apologize for pontificating. I don't mean to, but
no,
I just feel
it
what it is.
But it's interesting, but it's, you know, it's kind of frightening a little bit too. With the, when you look at the excuse me, the beautiful, you know, beautiful homes and of yesterday, and that's kind of frightening to think. I mean, of course, you know, life moves forward, and there are more people living on Earth today than have ever lived. I think there's that statistic in history. You know, we have so many people today. But, you know, do we want to give up our pretty antiques?
I don't know that we do. I've thought about that. I collect instruments, telescopes and things like that.
Yeah.
Now, I could never give up those, but I could certainly give up my sofa if I had something equal.
Well, on that subject,
what it looks like. Pardon?
On that subject, Bottle de Bray, your house, and I think a lot of people are interested to know, you have this most gorgeous, perfect perfectly decorated, filled with the most gorgeous antiques and furniture and accessories, and you sold it all. And I think people, how did you do that? I mean, how can you do that? I mean, it was just...
Well, part of it is the creative issue of doing something else. Part of it had to do with having to drive back and forth. I mean, I'll be very blunt with you. I hated going up there on Friday nights in the traffic, and I hated getting up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning to be in New York to beat the traffic. I didn't want to live that way anymore.
Yeah.
And that's basically what it was. It was a wonderful house. I had the experience to sit on that porch with the fireplace going at 10 o'clock in the morning and having coffee and reading a newspaper. There was no greater pleasure in life. It did, but there are other pleasures. And
yeah.
So you I think you have to accept that. Plus, I have Wanderlust, as the Germans call it. I mean, I'm, you know, it was the, if my life had not become even more complicated with the traveling that I do, I would have already built another house. Now, I'm somewhat, you know, if you live in an urban situation like New York City, it's goddamned hard to live outside the city because, first of all, I came in yesterday from North Carolina on a plane, and what would have ordinarily taken me 40 minutes took me almost an hour and a half because of traffic coming into New York at that hour of the morning.
Yeah,
I don't want to live that way. I just don't. I mean, but that's personal.
Yeah, no. I was kind of teasing you in a way, but I think people look at that. This, you know, and it could be something as personal as, you know, we wanted the money, you know, I mean, it's a lot of money to tie up in a house with possessions like that, you know, but the house was so perfect, you know, and you just sold it, and it just, I don't know, it would have been hard for me to do that, but I don't know the issue of time, like you say, I can't, you know, I live in Houston. We don't have that issue, you know, so.
Well, you do. I mean, you know, I got off a plane. I got up at I mean, I'm being very straightforward. I got up at 3:30 in the morning, yesterday morning, to get on a plane to be here for meetings. Tomorrow morning at 7:30, I leave for Chicago. I travel constantly.
Yeah.
I think that's subtext to the world of the future. If it's not with our minds, it's with our bodies. Or if it's not with our bodies, it's with our minds. And I read science fiction. I mean, I tell you, the Trinity on the screen here, the three of you, you read science fiction, you realize that people have... Oh, well, here's a story. Leonardo invented the helicopter in 1451.
I know, isn't that amazing?
And it did not come into being until Sikorsky in 1942. People dream about life, but that's not really the point. The point is that the world is changing, and the speed with which it's changing is incremental. And yes, Home Sweet Home, Pennsylvania was wonderful. All of those things, but I don't think people in the future are going to live that way. I mean, I don't know that. I can't. I'm not a prophet.
but yet, you say that you're building a house in Canada. Is that true? Are you still doing that? Because I was worried about. Now, how is it going to go to Canada?
It takes an hour and 5 minute flight from New York City to Montreal.
Is that all?
When you arrive in Montreal, I've gone to another world. And I have done a lot of work up there for clients there and in Florida, et cetera, et cetera. I love being up there. But it's another thing is that it's a different culture. The little village the little town that's near, where on the lake, near the lake where I'm going to build this house, is a charming village. It's a village. I lived in New York. I want a little contrast in my life.
Yeah.
I think change is a wonderful thing. Change that you can control. I've never forgotten. I mentioned the house and the porch, and we had a porch on the left side facing the house, and on the right also, but on the left. And it was a porch with rattan furniture that I still own. And I've never forgotten my father telling Ray Reed, the Reeds, who are friends of my parents. Ray Reed was talking about what he was going to do with his life, and my father said, I was a kid sitting there, it's as important to know how to get off stage as it is to get on. I'm 185 years old. I can go place goddamn hell I want. I've got enough money to be comfortable, not a lot.
You just took 3 years off.
Bang. Like,
we're the fountain of youth here at the Skirted Round Table.
Well, I'm moving in with you gals. You have to teach me. I'm luckily compass medicine physically okay, but the fact is that, there's many rhythms to life, and it's nice to have another theater to dance in.
So are you planning on buying, furnishing it kind of the same way in Canada?
No, absolutely not. No, I'm not against what I own, and we still have a lot of that. We sold a lot of it often, but I kept we kept the things that Jimmy and Steinmeier and I kept, the things that we really loved. You know where they are? They're in a warehouse.
Yeah.
So what style are you doing?
Well, I think it'll be a soft, modern style. I mean, it's the most important thing to me is what was great about Balderbury was, and I believe in it, we built several houses based on that, including one modern house, is one room living, meaning a great room that has a fireplace at one end and a fireplace at the other. On one end is a fireplace with dining and a kitchen off of it, and on the other is whatever you would choose. And in the middle is a place to sit and read, but it's one big room. I do not believe we're working on a house in Dallas now, and it has all these rooms, and that's wonderful because that's what they want. But for me, that I'm alone by myself, so to speak, I don't want all that. I just want a room that's filled with books and filled with one room that I live in, including workspace, you know, desk to work at.
I love the way, I just did on my blog, a long piece about Balderbray and who bought the house and what it looks like today. And then I kind of talked about your book, but you really notice you do have a way of designing a living space that you tend to use, or you repeat or whatever, because it's, you know, there's a center table.
Yep.
And it's piled with books, you know, and it's surrounded by little stool. You know, it's such a wonderful way of living, and you just have a way of the way you place your furniture. It's just so perfect. Mm-hmm. I mean, every piece of furniture, every pillow, every set. There's not one thing in a picture that I could say, "Oh, I don't like that." Oh, I don't. That's wrong. I mean, everything is. It's just perfect. I mean, you really have a good eye, I have to say.
Well, I've got a glass of red wine next to me because I've got to go out to dinner tonight, and I lift my glass to Albert Hadley and Sister Parrish, and to my parents to a certain extent, because my parents lived that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, God only knows. I mean, we had curtains and the upholstery. There was slip covers that went on in the summer over the upholstery. You know, all those kind of things that used to be. Mm-hmm. But I repeat again, the used to be is not what I think. I'm not against the past. I'm just saying that there's so many changes taking place. And I think I feel that to a great extent because of thinking about it and reading about it and trying to understand it, that it's going to change. And that's heartless in a way to say, but I think you look at how our lives, look at how our lives are, yours and mine have already changed.
Yeah, because of the internet.
The internet. I mean, technology is just, I mean, it's just awesome. And that is brain, but it's so fantastic. That's exciting to me.
But don't you think that all the technology is going to make people want their house to be their nest and their warm, safe spot?
I think there's going to be those who go forward, like David's saying, you know, who are going to embrace it and are going to take, you know, if something makes their lives easier or, you know, simplified and more comfortable, I think they'll go that way. But I do think there's always going to be some of us who want to, or, you know, want to keep it the same, the way it was, even though we're offered all these modern technology, you know, choices.
I'm going to say something bluntly, intelligently, fantastic. But not my...
to counter what I just said?
In a way, it does. Because I don't know that the value system of you all and David Easton underlined is the value system of the future, because the demographics of this world are changing so rapidly, just like the population, that with fused with technology. I'm sure there will be people. I mean, I don't deny that, but I still think that the richness of life is going to come from human intelligence and emotive reaction to that intelligence in itself. I keep apologizing for it, but I do all the time because I feel like I'm hurting people's feelings. But the fact is, there's going to be change. We've already seen it.
I guess I would say that everything in your book comes from human intelligence. You know,
yes,
classic design comes from human intelligence.
And I wouldn't deny that, hopefully, but also it reflects a world that existed that was cohesive, shared values that had gone on for centuries, generations, eons. And I think that's, I'm not being negative, I think it's creative and exciting. It's not going to be the same. Who in the future that is living lives that we've already seen happen going to want to live with a cabriole leg, as beautiful as a cabriole leg is? I don't know. Are they going to be science fiction I read, most people don't live any one place anymore. They're all over Hell's Half Acre, either physically or with their brain and technology.
I totally understand what you're saying, but I do think that there are some people who, you know, there's that because of all the modern technology. For instance, I can't stand e-bike. I can't stand e-bikes. I'd rather have a handwritten note, and that's so old-fashioned, you know, but that's not easy. But I'd rather have a letter would mean so much more to me than an email, because in it there's a human, you know, there's a human quality to it. Just, you know, like the beautiful art in your book. I mean, that to me, I could look at that as much as the photographs. I mean, those paintings are glorious, and they rival any sort of vector works, you know, crap that gets, you know, spattered out from computer. I mean, they don't rival, they trump it. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know? So I think that there's always going to be somebody who, with all this technology, is going to go, you know what, I've had it. I want to go back to where I was.
And I would not argue with that. I guess my main point is, I don't know what is, but I do know that I doubt very seriously if it's going to be a heavily curtained, upholstered, mm-hmm. room in the future.
I repeat
that I think comfort will be something not to you, and perhaps to a certain extent not to me, but it will be something different for other people.
I don't know.
I love the idea of the French called a frisson, a kind of tense excitement about change, and I find that intellectually satisfying, sometimes emotionally not so.
You know, it's interesting because I live in a little beach town in LA, and I live in a small 1940s bungalow that was originally designed for the lifestyles of the 40s. And all of these little bungalows are getting ripped down, and these massive houses are being built.
I don't like.
No, I don't either. But I think that, no, I can't stand it. And the interesting thing is that my house... Excuse me. My house, actually, from what everyone says, people come in and they go, oh, it's cozy. It is cozy, literally, but it's warm. And, you know, when I sit there and think about moving into a larger home, I think, but I'm so used to having my children so close to me. And we really all live together because of the size of the space. And if we moved, you know, the four of us into several thousand more square feet, we'd lose that, you know, and that's what's modern right now in this particular community, to have huge homes on small lots. And for some reason, you know, I keep going back to what was. I like the way we live, and we have to go to the market every day because we have no kitchen, you know, but that's every
kitchen.
We have a galley kitchen. I have a tiny kitchen. It's not something I would choose to have, but the things I've noticed because of it is that every day and this may sound like huge work to some people, I don't really have a pantry. So every day I get to sit down, and sometimes it seems like a lot of work, but I get to sit down and think, what am I going to create for dinner? And I every day I'm stopped for 20 minutes and I get to go there, which is creative to me. So, you know, the way I live to me is not modern because of the size of the space. Does that make sense? Like everyone around here is getting bigger. And
yes, it does. But I would say that America in the future is not going to have big houses.
Yeah.
I mean, I do feel with some intelligence of reading science fiction, that in the future, people just are not going to, almost 10 billion people, they're not going to be white Anglo-Saxon Christians that grew up in a way that we all did. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a mix. It's going to be another, it's going to be a cultural exchange. It will be a global world. And I think that's exciting in itself, but I think it will change the way we live. I just do. I don't have any proof of that. I don't think anyone can, except, as I said, my Bible of the future, the way we live, is reading science fiction.
Well, certainly, I mean, I love hearing your, you know, you keep saying blah, 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 that, but that's the point of the roundtable. I love just bouncing these ideas around. I don't know who's right or who's, you know, it's certainly great, especially speaking to someone like you who clearly has a lot of reading under his belt, to bring your ideas and hear them.
And I'm not, I keep apologizing for it. I don't know this, but I sense that it will not be the world I grew up in. Let me make it very personal. It will not be the finite world of a nation that was the most powerful, richest nation in the world. That's not in the future for us. America came of age at the Second World War, and we're already in a very few years going to be the third world power. And I'm not being negative. It's been marvelous. We've lived in a marvelous time in America. But the whole world is changing, and everything is first, second, third, or fourth until it's one and global. As trite as that word is, it is. But I feel that we're going to be a global world. And it's going to, the aesthetic value systems, the way we live, the way we dream, the way we eat and dance and everything else is going to be different. I wish I could live another 100 years to see what does happen. I might regret it.
You might. I think I agree with you, but I think it's certainly much farther out than 100 years. Yeah. You know, we're not going to suddenly tear down all of our old homes or even new homes. You know, I think people, eventually things will definitely change because people will change the way they live and things will be...
No arguments with that. Yeah. I agree. But I do think it's incremental change.
Yeah.
I mean, I suspect it is.
So tell us about your book. Is this your first book of your work?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the next one is about the future.
Oh, so you have a next one coming?
Well, we're conjuring up. It's going to be the way we will live now.
Oh, cool.
In the future.
In the future. So this current book, Timeless Elegance, how long did you take to put it all together?
I would say at least a year, plus about 40 years.
Plus 40, right. Plus the 40 years leading up to it.
I don't know, a year and a half. It was a difficult thing because we've never kept much record, and all of that is now a record in the book, but we had to go to clients and get things photographed, and... you know, we had traveled all over. We went north and south and all across the U.S.
So did you?
That's another thing. We have clients in Mexico. We have clients in Canada. We have clients in São Paulo, Brazil. I mean, at the world at work, and we work in. You know, we do boats, which are done in Amsterdam. I mean, it isn't like our parents grew up in a space. We're all over.
Right.
Everybody is. I don't know what brought that on, but I mean, the next book is about a global world and a global style and what it will be. And it's about technology and how it'll affect the way we live then.
Did you go and reshoot all of these projects, all of these homes for the book?
A lot of them, yes. Not all of them, but perhaps half of them. I'm making that up, but I think that's what it was.
Really? Huh.
And
You know why we did it? Because a lot of the things that comes from the impact of a room or a space is because people lived in them. not just have moved into them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of these houses were photographed right away, and so we went back and photographed them again. And it was a great pleasure, actually.
And
we've had wonderful clients, I will say. God, I've been very lucky.
You didn't go back into any of the houses and go, I can't believe they did this? I know you won't actually answer that question, but
no, I would. No, not really.
That's nice.
Not really. I mean, that brings up, this is, do a lot of people, if I say something kind of crazy, is it bad?
For us, no.
Okay. Well, Martha asked me, I don't know where she got it, but what is the strangest, what is the most frightening, exciting thing that ever happened in your life in terms of a surprise? And I said, the day I walked into an apartment building on Fifth Avenue, the clients were supposedly gone. We'd finished the job, but I brought a painter up to do some work and walked into the bedroom, and there was the lady of the house without the husband and the building superintendent in bed.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
Excellent.
I don't know who was more surprised, they or myself.
What did Martha's face look like when you said that?
Is she still together with her husband, though?
Yes.
Oh, God.
Super. Super.
Sneaky. Never mind.
Well, that's a full service building.
God. Now I hardly think so. Never mind.
What did Martha Stewart do when you told her that story?
There was a short silence throughout the audience, and then they all laughed.
And did she ask you for another, like your second most?
I think that was enough. Well, she asked me, and I told her.
That's right.
That's funny.
Do you have a favorite project in the book?
I think the most extraordinary client I ever had was clients down in Virginia that we built a house, stables, a farm store, a boat, major, a plane, and a house in Scotland. So those were wonderful challenges of a time and place. But, you know, I'd be very flippant saying, I suppose the most fascinating thing is the house of the future, you know, the next house you're going to do.
Yeah. Is that book in Virginia, is that house in Virginia in the book?
Yes. It's that one with the, not all this project. And a chapel. We did a chapel. Oh, that chapel.
Oh, that chapel is so beautiful.
Yeah.
And you designed the preacher's robes also?
Yes. Yeah, we did to a certain extent. We went to a religious couturier, if that's the way to phrase it, in London and had them made.
Oh, is that Albemarle?
That house is amazing.
Is that the Albemarle house?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know what I look back on as the greatest pleasure? Mar Lodge in Scotland. It was so wonderful. Beautiful house built in the 1870s. 1860s, 70s, and Scotland is so beautiful. I look back on the wonderful times I've had traveling there and sitting at that restaurant by a stream. The fish came from that, and sitting there drinking, and I love drinking and having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lovely. I've been very lucky. We all have been lucky in the times we've grown up in.
Yes.
The security that we've had. Until very recently, and the wealth we've had, and the value systems that we've had because of a cohesive society. It's been wonderful. Living Well is the Best Revenge. There's a wonderful book written by a guy named Tompkins about the Murphys. His family owned a luggage business here in New York City, and he traces them from New England and New York, Tompkins goes, to Antibes in France, and the wonderful life they created for themselves with Picasso at the table, and you know, the whole world that they got. And I've always thought, look back on that as what a wonderful vision of life that they had, that they could live that way. I don't know that people will in the future. I don't know. Anyway, whatever it is, we've had a wonderful time at this party that we've lived in. We've been so lucky to be in America. It's just been a spectacular place.
I mean, plus to be free and to think how so many people have lived enslaved and still do live enslaved. And
yeah.
We have everything we want, you know.
Right. Well, even, I mean, most of us in this country, even if you don't have a lot, you have so much more than what most people in the world have.
We have had one great value, security,
yeah,
on every single level. Never have we been in, I mean, there's never been a real challenge except, you know, Spanish American, I mean, minor. But whatever it is, we have lived an unbelievable time, and I think the work in this book that I did represents the security. I think the other thing I would say, the wonderful part about the office has been, I'm trying to think of something other than being ponderous and serious, that we've had a wonderful office because we've been able to do so many things that have been accrued by our forefathers here in America, the wealth and the security that brought us. I've been able to travel all over the globe with you know, product. You know, we've worked in France, we've worked in Belgium, we still work in Belgium. We've worked in Portugal, we've worked in England. You know, if I stop to think about where we haven't been, it'd be hard to say. We've worked in India. I don't mean doing houses, but I mean doing, you know, getting product done. And that's been a wonderful experience. I love travel.
How big, David, is your staff?
Huh?
How big is your staff?
I've got about 18 or 20 people.
And how many projects do you do a year?
Well, they last for so long that we have Malibu, São Paulo, Mexico City, and then several jobs here in New York, and maybe some others I don't know, and two in Chicago.
So you keep busy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't seem huge that your staff's huge.
I know. That's not a big staff for that many.
Oh, no, but they don't all happen. You know, when you have projects like this that start with architecture and end up with moving in, it doesn't happen quickly.
Right.
There's a staff of architects, there's a staff of decorators, and there's management people. It's the way it's always been. Then there's red wine for lunch.
You got to have it.
We have a wonderful office here in New York. If you ever come to New York, please call and we'll take you to dinner and we'll go drinking. But we have offices that overlook Union Square and these great big windows, and there's a park out. It's very nice space. We've got 12-foot ceilings and it's beautiful here.
I think I'm going to be there after between the week between Christmas and New Year's, so I might have to let you know beforehand to see if you're around, just to come stop by and check it out.
Why don't the three of you, as three graces, come? No, I'm call me. We'll be glad to entertain you.
Do you know the three of us have never met each other in person?
Weird.
That is weird. How in the hell did you guys hook up? You ladies hook up?
On the internet through our blogs. See?
Wow. Well, hey, listen. There you are, speaking about the future.
Right.
Yeah.
Da da da. We. Yeah. So, you met each other on, but you've all met personally.
No.
Never. God damn, I love it.
I know.
There we go. So, it used to take place at home or at the country club. Look at this.
That's right.
I know.
It's wonderful. That's a wonderful story in itself.
We're all over the country, and we just haven't managed to meet each other in
person. And the funny thing is, people will say to me, you know, just out and about, well, you've met Joni and Linda, right? And I said, no. And they'll say, I thought you knew them. I said, I consider them good friends of mine. I talk to them every week. So that's the funny thing. We have not met in person.
Right.
Maybe the three of you all have ESP. Extrasensory perception.
Could be.
No, I think that's true. You know, it's funny because you can walk into a room, as we all do, and you can, and I've discussed this with other people. You can walk into a room and look around and say, well, there's someone I want to talk to and there's someone I don't. So maybe now it's just happening on the screen.
Yeah.
On your computer.
That's true, though. I mean, you do pick up a nuance of someone's personality on internet very quickly through emails and everything.
Okay. Well, David, I think this has been really, really fascinating to talk to you. I mean, fun and so great to sort of hear, you know, not just talk about, okay, here's a pretty picture, but really talk about ideas, which is fun.
Next time we'll talk about the real blood, sweat, and tears that goes into it. Getting it done, right? You all know that.
Thank you so much, David.
Great. You're very welcome. Enjoyed the conversation with the three of you. The Trinity.
The Trinity.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. This has been the Skirted Roundtable with Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8, Joni Webb from Cote de Texas, and Alinda Merrill from Surroundings. And this week we are joined by noted interior designer and architect David Easton. Thank you so much for joining us. You can visit us online at www.skirtedroundtable.blogspot.com or download our podcasts from iTunes. Search for the Skirted Roundtable. Thank you so much, and we'll be back soon.